Jacksonville, the most misunderstood city in America? Why a growing number of travel writers say our very own Duval is a hidden gem. Just ahead, we'll hear your favorite local spots. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, this city is getting some street cred. We want to hear your favorite night spots, restaurants, beach hangouts, and city places to go around town as we talk about Jacksonville. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a look at the Trump tariffs and their impact on our economy. Plus, Science on Tap takes over Intuition Aleworks this week. How you can tap into that, all of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, Jacksonville. Well, we've come a long way since the last of those smelly pulp mills closed and we hosted a Super Bowl to many complaints over a decade ago. But times have changed and more young people are flocking into this city to create a growing and unique and progressive culture. And more people from outside this area are beginning to notice, like the website Thrillist. Last week, an article appeared there praising Jacksonville as a vibrant and affordable place to live and visit. In fact, editor Matt Meltzer, the Miami editor for Thrillist, called Jacksonville the most misunderstood city in America. More than Buffalo, Detroit, Pittsburgh. Pretty interesting. You can read the article on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. In the meantime, Matt Meltzer's on the line with his impressions of North Florida. Matt, good to talk to you. Good morning.
Nice to talk to you, too. I'm honored to be considered one of the First Coast's most compelling newsmakers. I think that's the first time anyone's ever called me that, and I am honored.
You're very compelling.
Title, so thank you.
I am utterly compelled by the sound of your voice.
Thank you.
All right, and we want to hear lots of voices right now. Give us a call as we talk about Jacksonville. Getting rave reviews. This isn't the first one that's popped up in the last few years, by the way, but the new one is on Thrillist. As travel writers from around the country discover our hidden gem quality, which, by the way, many of you would like to keep hidden, but we'd like to hear your thoughts right now. Give us a call. Where's your favorite little spot in town? Your favorite neighborhood? Your favorite bar? Your favorite restaurant? Your favorite art gallery? Are you a beach person or a city person? We want to hear from all corners of town. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or weigh in on our Facebook page. Okay, Matt, what prompted you? You're down in Miami. What prompted you to head up to this corner of the state and write this piece about Jacksonville?
Well, I was actually up at the Players Championship, and you know, golf is interesting, but I think that more of it was taking a look at what the city had to offer. You know, what I've done a number of stories about these cities that people tend to talk down on, and I think what really is interesting to me is going to those cities and finding out what's interesting about them and why they're great. And the Players Championship was sort of the nice backdrop for me to do that. I mean, the tournament's great, obviously it's a fantastic event, but I really wanted to see what the city was offering beyond a once-a-year golf tournament.
Sure. And the headline to your piece, "This Secret Gem on the Coast is Actually Getting Cool Again." The "actually," I think, is the key word in that article.
This
element of surprise that you seem to have as you headed all over town, checked out different neighborhoods. You went from Springfield to the Cork Arts District to the beach. And you seem so pleasantly surprised by the amazing quality of life here and the culture here, the arts and culture that's really just taken off in the last 10 years. You seem surprised.
If people in South Florida, certainly when you say Jacksonville, they basically assume you're going to the middle of South Carolina somewhere. Maybe there's a beach there. We're not sure, but we've heard that there's a beach there. And the problem is, of course, most people don't actually bother going. When I went, I remember the first day I went and did a yoga class on the beach out there in Atlantic Beach, and it felt like Santa Monica. You know, it felt like Venice Beach. It had that just relaxed, cool breeze. I mean, it was May. You don't get it in August. But, you know, that nice, relaxed, cool breeze feel and people jogging and just sort of this healthy lifestyle feel. getting out on the water. I mean, it just felt very, very West Coast, very California. I don't know if you consider that a compliment or not. I'm from California originally. It just did not feel like what people in the rest of the country sort of think of Jacksonville as being. And then investigating the neighborhoods and going to Cork Arts and seeing that there's people there doing creative, interesting things. Just not something that people associate with that city. It seems like some people want it to stay that way, but I thought, gosh, this is, I mean, not only would be an interesting place to live, but certainly to come and spend a weekend and see some things that are very, very different, even from other parts of the state. Just really enjoyed it. And I think it's worth visiting for anybody who wants something. And it's cheaper. I mean, it's affordable. It's a place you can go and do those things without coming back and feeling like, you know, you got your wallet raided when you were visiting somewhere like you do in Vegas or Miami or somewhere else.
Right. It's 549-2937. Call us up from all over Duval with ideas about your favorite places to go around town. And, you know, something else that you got into in this piece, Matt, I'm not from here. I moved here in 2003, actually from Orlando. But you point out that many of the people who've made the biggest impact in Jacksonville in the last decade were people that grew up here, left because they were so frustrated with what they saw as a very stagnant, overly conservative culture, and then came back and decided to make an impact and bring the city back to the creative heyday that people still talk about from nearly a century ago, in particular the 1920s, when the city was alive with jazz and restaurants and theaters, and it was known as the Harlem of the South. And there is really a strong cohort of folks, whether they're restaurateurs or artists or business people, that have left, gone to bigger cities, and then come back here to try to change the culture. And I was glad to see that you noted that, because it really is a thing here, and it's obviously something that didn't escape your notice.
No, I mean, I kind of was pointed that out by Jonathan Insetta, who runs Black Sheep and Orsay, and he said, you know, that's what's going on. And look, if I had grown up in Jacksonville, I could see taking for granted the beaches and the waterways and the perfect weather. But if you go live in New York City or Chicago or even Los Angeles for a while, you realize what a great thing you have there. I mean, if I had grown up there and left, I would go back too. You know, having that much beautiful nature to yourself, you know, not having to share it like you do in California or in other parts of the state, and go back and say, wow, there's really a great quality of life here, and maybe I can go back and make an impact. And the interesting thing that Jonathan pointed out to me, which is true, it's a small city, and you can go have an impact very quickly if you're a creative person. You know, if you want to go to Austin, Texas and be creative, that's great. Everyone in the world is going to Austin to do that right now. Going to a place like Jacksonville, where you have this great weather and this great laid-back beach culture, this great outdoors culture, to go there and be an artist or be a restaurateur or be a chef, it seems like it's a lot easier to make an impact. And I mean, honestly, I was impressed that people were coming back, and I don't blame them. I mean, if I was from there and saw the cost of living and how it was in the rest of America right now, I would go back there in a heartbeat.
And what did you think about the fact that so many people said to you, don't tell our story? We don't want to be overcrowded and overpriced. We'd like to keep things a little hidden.
Man, I tell you what, if you all had traffic, that would be a very hard place to live, because it is a long way to get from place to place.
Well, we have it, but I mean, I used to live in Chicago, so that's traffic. We have traffic, but it's not traffic, you know?
Yeah, it's manageable. I mean, it's not like L.A., right? L.A. is spread out like Jacksonville is, but there's 18 million people there, so it takes an hour to get anywhere. I could see why you all wouldn't want traffic. There weren't a ton of people that said, don't get the secret out. I think most of the people really wanted people to come to Jacksonville, but I can understand having, like I said, this great little slice of nature there and this really nice laid-back outdoor lifestyle and not wanting to have to share it with so many other people. I mean, people from Denver and people from Austin and people from Seattle, which is where I'm from, also talk about how it used to be that you could go to do all these nice things outside and no one was there, and now they're so packed. I can see Jacksonville not wanting that to happen, because, it sucks when that happens to your city, you know?
Right. And as the city grows and as more and more people learn about all of the great things about this place we call home, we're talking with Matt Meltzer, a Miami editor with Thrillist, as he explores Jacksonville as a hidden gem. Where are your favorite hidden gems around town? Your favorite neighborhoods? What are your favorite parts about living here? 549-2937. Millen is in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Millen, good morning. Oh, turn your radio down and go ahead and talk to us. All right, we'll give you a call back. Susan in Jacksonville. Hi, Susan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. So I wanted to share a story on how I ended up in Jacksonville. I moved back east after 10 years in San Diego, and I had a unique opportunity to live anywhere, so that kind of presented too many options. So I kind of approached it with some analytics. And mind you, I had never been to Jacksonville before I did this. I made a list. I said, I have to have a beach. It needs to be dog friendly. It needs to have a certain population density, certain climate. Needs to, you know, be on the East Coast where, I grew up in this kind of culture. So when I put all the numbers in, I put all the statistics in and researched online all the demographics, it said Jacksonville, Florida. And I said, maybe I should go check out Jacksonville because I've never been there before.
Really?
So after about 6 months, yeah. So I'm like, okay, let's get in the car and go. So I came over here, spent like 3 days in a rental car, put 400 miles on it, just driving everywhere from the Georgia state line all the way down to St. Augustine. And I live here now. I live in a wonderful neighborhood off of Atlantic Boulevard, about 4 miles in from the beach. I take my dog out to Atlantic Beach all the time. He's off leash, plays in the water. I love it. My neighborhood is gorgeous. There's giant trees. There's wildlife everywhere. You'd never know that there's this bustling city with 6 lanes of traffic less than half a mile from my house.
Yeah.
I love this. And I would have never found it had I been looking at the most popular places to live. What's trending? It was the approach of looking at the data that brought me here.
Yeah.
And I don't regret a single moment of it.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for sharing that. And lots of other folks waiting to tell their stories. Chris is in Avondale. Hey, Chris. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hi, I'm a third-generation Jacksonvillian, and I have watched this town for, well, my entire life. And I grew up in an artistic community, and when Riverside was still the scary place to go, and played in many bands here, and then I got into television and worked in television for many years and found that the problem wasn't the artists that were here in town. The problem was the conservative attitude that this town had. And I don't want to place a label on it. I don't want to say that, you know, this is a conservative Republican town or anything like that. But the businesses here weren't used to creative options. And now I'm seeing it change more with the youth coming in. And I think that we've got a very bright future here. But on the other hand, I like it here as a small, big town, and I don't know that I want to see, you know, people coming in and taking advantage of our quiet, little, beautiful Florida community.
Right. So you appreciate the growth, but you don't want it to become unmanageable. And it's interesting to hear your perspective, too, as a native, Chris, as opposed to someone like the previous caller who moved here. This city has, and by the way, Matt, you may already know this. I think it's true that this city has the highest percentage of native-born people of a large Florida city, whereas the rest of the state is a lot of transplants. Here in Jacksonville, there are a lot of native-born folks like you, Chris, and that has kept this very consistent kind of traditional culture for a lot of years. But now we're seeing a lot more transplants move in, which has changed the town quite a bit.
And I also don't want to see it become, I mean, I love Austin, Texas more than you can believe, but I don't want to see it become an Austin where nobody is from Austin.
Right.
You know, there are no Austinites anymore. They've
Everybody's flocking there for what they think is a gold rush. Yeah. Yeah.
And we have a really rich culture here. There is a huge, rich culture here that has been untapped, and I like the fact that it's kind of quiet, that we have it for our own. I don't want people to look at us like, and pardon, I know this is a bad term now with words, but I don't want people to look at us like the South Georgia white trash of North Florida. You know, there's a lot here that people don't know about. Why do you think all the NFL players move here?
Yeah, after they're done playing. Yeah, thanks, Chris. Matt, what do you think of Chris's perspective there?
I find it interesting that Austin is now being held up as a city people don't want to become. And I agree. I've been to Austin. I think it's horrible now, the last year or so. And I would hate to see that happen to Jacksonville. It's a double-edged sword. Because if you have that perception of being a backwater, redneck city, people aren't going to move there and you'll have all that stuff to yourself. If people discover it as being a cultural, artistic place with a beach, well, who doesn't want to live in a place like that? So it's hard to say, well, we want some people, but not that many people. It seems like you've managed growth pretty well so far. But the next 10 years, as the stories like this and others get out, it may become a place that people go, oh, hey, wow, this is a cool beach city where I can afford to live. And
well,
again,
you just told the world that, Matt.
Yeah, sorry. But that's at least it's changing the perception a little bit. And look, that perception is still out there a lot, because when I told people I was going to Jacksonville, the first thing people said was why. So not everyone knows yet, but I hope that perception changes, because it really is a very lovely place to go.
Jack is in Fernandina Beach. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Although I don't live in Jacksonville, I volunteer down at the airport. And I wanted to tell you a couple things about the airport and toot their horn. I'm an ambassador down there, and they posted a newspaper clipping that some travel magazine voted Jacksonville's airport as the most friendliest airport in the United States. I'm an ambassador on Sunday mornings, and I'm helping people there, and me and my partner take the attitude of, we look for people coming in or going that has a deer in the headlights look in their face and says, can I help you? And as best we can, we answer their questions and get them along. And also, people have commented to us that the airport is the cleanest airport that they've ever been. And all I got to say is, bravo to the airport.
It's so true. And as someone who's been to many, many airports, Jack, I have to agree with you. Our airport is another part of just the overall good quality of life. And Matt, no ding on Miami, but I have to say, I've been through Miami's airport a lot. And our airport is way better than your airport.
Our airport's rough. I mean, the ambassadors there are, I'm going to say, difficult to communicate with sometimes if you're looking for something there. So it is refreshing to be able to communicate what you need clearly with people who work there. I had a great experience in Jacksonville, but Miami is... it's Miami. We have some great things, but we have some challenges down here, too.
All right. Mary is in San Marco. Hi, Mary. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was not born here, but I was raised here through elementary and high school and moved away and came back. And what I like the most about this area is all the parks, national, state, and local city parks. They're really a wonderful part of being here. Every day you can get away.
Yeah, we have the largest urban park system in the United States, and it's true. It's just so much green space everywhere. Matt, did you get the chance to visit any parks when you were up here?
I didn't. I did see them, and there is a lot of green space up there. It is a very lush area when you fly in. Unfortunately, again, my time was limited, but I did get to get out on the water and get on a boat and go on a golf course, and I saw a lot of what the great nature you had there.
Here is an email from Danae. Yes, Jacksonville is changing, getting better, more sophisticated, but the haves and have not problem here is huge and growing as prices grow up. More and more people will hopefully outnumber the conservative, often unconscious population of days gone by. Coming from Seattle, I really appreciate the friendliness of this town. Here is a tweet. This one is from the outgoing director of the Cultural Council, Tony Allegretti. It's hard to keep cool secret spots when you're the 12th largest city in the country. I love the pocket parks at the end of our older neighborhoods with a great grid to the river. Watching the sun come up on the South Bank is great, too. Stephanie tweets us. We could have moved anywhere. We wanted to be near the Gulf arts community, not a super city or uber tourist. Jacksonville rose to the top. We've been here 7 years and still love it. And yes, The airport is really friendly. Lots of comments, too. You can check them out on our First Coast Connect Facebook page as we talk with Matt Meltzer of Thrillist. Let's take a few more calls. Peter is in Arlington right now. Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I first came to Jacksonville when I was stationed here 25 years ago. And obviously, I enjoyed it. The scenery, the vistas, the parks are wonderful, especially my favorite, family's favorite is Little Talbot. And I always told myself when I first got here that, you know, Jacksonville, you can always find a job. It might not be a great paying job, but it seems there's plenty of jobs. So that would be my only complaint is, you know, maybe if they attracted more higher paying manufacturers or whatever to come here. But, yeah, I found, you know, we're close to Disney. We're close to Daytona, close to St. Augustine. Yet we've still got that small town feel. And that's what really attracted me to Jacksonville.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Peter. Arun in Nocatee. Hey, Arun, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. One thing I wanted to bring out is the Nocatee area, which is like a live area. People, I mean, you can see the natural colors of the nature on a day-to-day life. So a lot of I've been here for the last 9 years, and my friends, whenever I send pictures of Nocatee, my backyard with a lake and the colorful scenic beauties, they'll say, hey, you should not be coming to any of us. We should be coming to you because it's a nature, lifestyle, resort-style area you guys are living in. And so I'm very proud of being in Jacksonville and especially in Nocatee area.
Yeah, it is beautiful. Thanks for that, Arun. Yeah, we are getting calls from all over our listening area. As you pointed out, Matt, the city is two-thirds the size of Rhode Island. That's a good analogy to point out how big this place is.
It is huge. And I'm impressed by the amount of pride that people have in it. It's not like New Jersey or Pittsburgh or somewhere where it's very in-your-face pride. No one really talks it up. If you meet someone from Jacksonville, they're not going crazy about it. But when you write a story like this or just hearing the people call in, hey, the people who live there are really, really proud of the city. And I think that's just a fantastic thing to have.
Let's take one more call. It's Chuck in Jacksonville Beach. Hey, Chuck, you have some recommendations, don't you?
Yes, I do. I want to mention, and I'm hoping you're familiar with Ellen's Kitchen in Neptune Beach. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
My best favorite. And then there is, we're so blessed to have Players by the Sea, the Alhambra.
Yeah, great theaters.
And yes, and when I was growing up, and it's still there, I don't drink alcohol and haven't done it in 30 years, but haven't been there, but there's Peach Bar in Neptune Beach. It's been there forever. And not that I would have ever done anything like that when I was younger, or, you know, try to get a drink in there when you weren't of age, but it's been around forever. So those are my, no, I wouldn't do that. Peach Bar, Ellen's Kitchen, Alhambra, Players by the Sea. Thanks,
yeah,
guys.
Thanks, Chuck. Yeah, all great recommendations out at the beaches. And it, as Matt's article points out, you can find your corner of this city and really thrive because it's a city of neighborhoods, so many choices. We moved to Springfield about, 8 months ago, and it's been a whole new lifestyle for my family, Matt, because we went from the suburbs to this historic neighborhood that's really just growing by leaps and bounds. And it's just one example, I think, of the vibrancy that we are all experiencing here. And so did you have a favorite place out of all the spots you visited when you were here?
I really liked Riverside. I thought that was just a really just compelling neighborhood. It looked like the kind of place that if I was going to move there, it would be where I moved. It's real close to downtown. You have those cool older homes. There's lots of small businesses, cool looking restaurants, coffee shops. Just seemed like a great place for a young person to live. The beach was great too, but it's the beach. You know, I love the beach, but it's definitely a beach culture there, which is great. But I think is still a beach culture, which is different to live than to visit.
Yeah. Well, people can check out the article. We have it posted on our Facebook page. It's at Thrillist.com. Matt Meltzer, Miami editor for Thrillist, on the line from South Florida. Thanks for being with us, and come back and visit us again soon.
Absolutely. Would love to. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And much more still ahead on the show later this morning. Do you believe in life in outer space? Do you secretly watch Ancient Aliens? You know what I'm talking about. The guy with the hair? Yeah, well, that's the question at this week's first ever Science on Tap. It's a serious question, too. We will tell you how you can be part of it. But up next, why economists say the math does not add up for the Trump tariffs. A closer look at their impact on the economy. Back in a moment.
I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. It's hurricane season. Prepare now by learning your evacuation zone, updating your disaster kit to include water, non-perishable food items, a flashlight with extra batteries, a radio, and other important items. Pick up a 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide at your public library and visit jacksready.com for more information. Tune your radio to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, over the weekend, President Trump said in a tweet that the tariffs his administration has imposed on steel, aluminum, and a variety of imported Chinese goods will soon begin to generate sufficient revenue to reduce the federal debt. Economists, however, say the math is not on his side. Now, for this fiscal year, the Congressional Budget Office projects the federal budget deficit will be $800 billion. Mr. Trump's Office of Management and Budget projects the deficit will top $1 trillion in 2019. So that means to pay down the debt, tariffs need to bring in at least $800 billion this year. Most economists say that's not a realistic figure. Meanwhile, this week, the nation's biggest aluminum maker, Alcoa, asked the White House for an exemption from the 10% tariffs on their product. That may seem surprising, but the reason for that is that Alcoa imports much of its aluminum from its facilities in Canada, which is among the countries subject to the Trump administration's metals tariffs. This shows you how interlinked our economy is with all of these different products and nations. Alcoa's move also underscores the risk the Trump administration faces as it tries to protect American firms by putting up trade barriers. The tariffs may well help some companies, but they also have the potential to hurt thousands of others. It's a complicated picture. Can the tariffs pay off for our economy? Cord McLaughlin is portfolio manager with Legacy Trust Family Wealth Offices here on the First Coast. He's been looking at this, and he joins us now with some insights into the Trump tariffs. Good morning, Cord.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right. So just this week, Alcoa said, hey, we don't want the protection of these tariffs because we're getting our aluminum from Canada. It's actually going to hurt us. So as you look at this, it's a complicated picture. But can the White House promise of the tariffs making up and paying down the national deficit, can that come to pass, first off? What do you think?
So I think it's believe it's important to go ahead and separate the tariffs that have been implemented from those that are under discussion. So if we look at the tariffs that have been implemented, the administration has imposed tariffs on $90 billion of goods in total. And the average tariff rate across those $90 billion of goods is approximately 22%. So to reduce the deficit of $800 billion, that's obviously not going to make a dent in that total number. As it pertains to China, the U.S. has imposed a 25% tariff on $34 billion worth of goods.
Yeah.
You know, in the grand scheme of things, in absolute terms, these numbers sound rather large, but it's important to maintain perspective as well on that $90 billion of goods that have tariffs imposed on them. The U.S. imported $2.3 trillion of goods in 2017. And so this $90 billion represents only about 3.9% of total imports for the U.S.
Okay, so what do you think about the old maxim that nobody wins in a trade war? That if we slap tariffs on China, they'll retaliate. And in the end, businesses will end up getting hurt along with consumers. Do you agree or disagree with that? Where do you think that falls?
I absolutely agree. Yeah, nobody wins a trade war. It's a trade war presents a lose-lose scenario for all parties involved. For instance, for the U.S. particularly, higher tariffs will eventually lead to higher prices for consumers. As Apple said on their latest conference call, tariffs show up as a tax on the consumer. And these higher prices, which will eventually feed through into a reduction in consumer spending, is going to affect overall economic growth. Consumer spending accounts for approximately 70% of economic growth here in the United States.
You're a portfolio manager. You probably have a number of clients who are following this closely. How are you advising them as we navigate through this?
There's a lot of uncertainties in regards to trade relationships and how things are going to evolve from here. You know, we are strong proponents of diversification at Legacy Trust Company. So, you know, we always advise investors that they should be positioned to withstand volatile market swings, as it does not appear that the saber rattling around tariffs is going to calm down anytime soon.
And do you anticipate that the damage from these tariffs might be enough that eventually business interests might apply enough pressure on the White House to say, look, this isn't working the way that you had hoped? I mean, we see, for example, the Koch brothers, a very conservative, powerful group, family saying to the president, look, we don't want this. This isn't good for business.
I think it's hard to influence President Trump in the grand scheme of things. But I do think there will become a point in time to where businesses will start to speak up a bit more in regards to the impact that it's having on their businesses.
Where do you see that coming most loudly? What sectors of the investment pie that you look at regularly?
So broadly speaking, from an economic perspective, we have started to see some preliminary effects on the manufacturing sector of the U.S. economy. So that's what we've seen so far. Businesses have started to experience input price pressures in the manufacturing sector of the business of the U.S. economy. However, the extent in which businesses have passed these price pressures on to the consumer has been minimal so far. So we haven't really seen that feed through to overall inflation numbers.
Yeah. Okay. And here's an email from Ed. We keep hearing about the tariffs and counter tariffs, but what if the president is right? Are we unfairly getting the short end of the stick from other countries who are penalizing our products, our industries, and our workers? What do you think?
It's been a part of globalization. I mean, there's been a move towards globalization over the past, three decades, if you will. Simply put, I mean, that's how we got here. The U.S. views China as a violator of intellectual property rights and as failing to have a bilateral trade relationship. And so I think there are ways to make the trade relationship a bit more even for both parties.
What would be a better solution in your view?
Well, you know, China, they have a few options to make the trade relationship a bit more reciprocal for the United States. For instance, they could open up the service sector in their economy to foreign ownership limits. They could reduce their import taxes that they impose. They could loosen, technology transfer requirements for direct investment, or they could just increase their total amount of imports that they pull from the United States.
Yeah.
Which would help that trade deficit.
That would help. But as yet, it's been difficult to pressure the Chinese It seems it seems the president is trying this blunt instrument of the tariffs to sort of lay down a marker and force them to change their ways, but it's backfiring.
For the most part, so far.
Where is it not backfiring?
I don't believe I believe it's backfiring.
You do.
In general. At this point in time. So recent U.S. negotiation tactics have really followed a rather consistent pattern, if you will. Headline threats followed by compromise and narrow implementation. I shouldn't say it's backfiring completely because we have had rather recent successful negotiations with the European Union to lift to have them increase their imports of U.S. soybeans, which is going to help take pressure off the tariffs that have been imposed by China on the soybean industry mm-hmm. here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that got a lot of publicity, too. As we speak with Cord McLaughlin of Legacy Trust, what are your thoughts on the Trump tariffs? 549-2937. Bill in Mandarin. Hey, Bill. How are you?
Good, good. I think the president's making a big mistake in anybody else linking the intellectual property theft with the war tariff. Those are separate items and should be treated separately. Also, as I recall, earlier uses of tariffs going back 200 and 300 years were indeed used to raise taxes, kind of a user tax, because there were no national income tax. I think recently it wasn't until like early 1900s it became a wall to protect local economies. Thanks very much.
Thanks for that. Yeah. Okay. And as he points out, too, this is not an economic tool that's been used really at all in the modern era, right, Cord? Not since the World War II era.
So we did see President Bush back in 2002 implement tariffs on steel. There was a 40% tariff on steel imports, which was not a successful implementation of tariffs. It led to the U.S. economy losing about 400,000 jobs, and he repealed those tariffs mm-hmm. in about a year.
Yeah, it tends to backfire, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Right, and this move from Alcoa to me is so emblematic of this. The president's trying to protect industries like Alcoa, the nation's biggest aluminum maker, but they've asked to be exempted from this whole program because they're importing their aluminum from Canada, which is subject to tariffs. So it has backfired on Alcoa. It is not protecting Alcoa.
It's not. It's going to affect their bottom line at some point. You know, Alcoa did come out with very strong earnings for the second quarter, but you know, going forward, at some point, the increased prices that they're having to pay for their aluminum imports is going to start to affect their earnings.
To me, you know, and let me ask you your thoughts on this too. The tariffs are very much a nationalistic move. America first. What the president ran on. We're going to take care of ourselves first. But what this economic approach seems to not understand is how interlinked and global the economy truly is. And the Alcoa example, I think, is a perfect example of that. And how does that impact your business? Because I'm sure your clients have a number of foreign investments as well as domestic.
Absolutely. We certainly believe in broad global diversification in our portfolios, which means not only investing here in the United States, but also internationally. You know, there's tremendous growth opportunities abroad, but you have to be able to withstand the additional volatility that's going to come from that. It certainly led to volatile market movements on a year-to-date basis, with emerging market equities down about 7%. But nevertheless, emerging market economies are the global growth engine of the world.
If you can stand the risk.
If you can stand the risk. Absolutely.
Okay.
So it's all about, you know, how much risk you can tolerate and where you stand relative to your investment time horizon.
And how does that make your life? You seem like a pretty calm guy, but I'm sure it's been interesting the last couple of years.
It certainly has been.
What is your strategy? And what is your strategy for your clients? Because as you said a few minutes ago, you expect more volatility.
We do.
What's your biggest worry for your clients and their portfolios? What keeps you up at night?
Well, what keeps me up at night? Well, there's a lot of things, as you can imagine. You know, certainly at this point in time, our international exposure can keep me up at night. But with that being said, the fundamentals abroad are still solid. We're seeing double-digit earnings growth in both international developed and emerging market equities. So it's an attractive place that we want to be. And then, like I said before, emerging market economies serve as the global growth engine. Between the next 10 years, it's estimated that emerging market economies are going to account for approximately 70% of global economic growth. So we want to have some of that growth in our clients' portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of seeing past the short term and focusing on the long term. Now, with that being said, we are also diversified investors. So we have investments in our portfolios that are going to hold up rather well, if not deliver positive returns should volatility increase.
So if someone's new to investing and they were to come to you, what advice would you be giving them right now in this economic climate where we are seeing a strong economy, unemployment is low, the markets are doing well, but there are some warning signs out there?
Absolutely. So we always advise that you've got to stay focused on the long term. Investing is not a short term gain. Nobody can prognosticate on what's going to happen in the markets here within the next 3 to 6 months, but we do believe that our portfolios will deliver strong positive returns over a long-term time horizon, meaning, the next 5 to 10 years. So you really have to separate the noise on a day-to-day basis from the facts. And the facts are evident in regards to the U.S. economy is growing at a strong rate. Second quarter economic growth rates just came out 2 weeks ago and showed the U.S. economy growing at a 4.1% growth rate. Earnings, simply put, here in the United States for equities are phenomenal.
So all good news. Okay. One last question. Do you have clients that panic when they read a headline or they see something about a particular piece of their investment and they ask you to pull their money out?
To be honest with you, we don't.
You don't.
And that's because we try to prepare our clients as much as possible for these periods of volatility and reiterate the importance of staying focused on the long term. Not only their long-term investment plan, but the long-term growth of their portfolio.
Good advice. And thanks for sharing it with us.
Absolutely.
He's Cordon McLaughlin, portfolio manager with Legacy Trust Family Wealth Offices here on the First Coast. As we talked about the tariffs impacting our economy and a lot more, a quick break. And in a moment, a look ahead to this week's first ever Science on Tap, how you can enjoy Intuition Aleworks and talk science all at the same time. That's right after this. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Quick break and we'll be right back.
And palliative care. Since 1979, the Compassionate Guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com. Arbus Magazine, focusing on the arts, business, and culture that enhance the quality of life in our community. July-August Markin issue features the Lost Bird Project and The River Comes of Age. Arbus Magazine, in depth, in touch. Arbus.com.
Next time on The World, it's pronouns. If they, them, there is a hot topic now in the U.S., it's old hat in Sweden, where an ungendered pronoun raised a fuss a few years ago.
People were sort of concerned that children would not know their own gender and would be sort of confused and unhappy for the rest of their lives.
how a new pronoun caused controversy in Sweden but also solved some problems. It's The World, this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Trump's billionaire friend who helped connect Trump to Arab princes. We talk with New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick. We'll also discuss his new book about covering the Egyptian revolution and subsequent coup when Kirkpatrick was Cairo bureau chief. It's also about the Obama administration's response. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
America's first full casualty of climate change could be Tangier Island, a tiny slip of land in Chesapeake Bay. Most of its men are crab fishermen. Many women run small businesses. This isolated spot is literally sinking into the bay. How science and sea rise are clashing with a community that's not sure about climate change. Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, lovers of science, mark your calendar for a special event this week. It's the first ever Science on Tap. And here's the question that will be on tap. Are we alone in the universe? Creators of Science on Tap, Josh Gellers and Eddie Whistler, are here with this preview. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Melissa.
Okay, so tomorrow night at Intuition Aleworks, the question will be posed, there or not there, the case for E.T.
Great title.
Did you come up with it?
No, it was the speakers.
Okay. So this is an idea that you guys have cooked up where you get people together, they have some beers, and they talk science.
Sounds revolutionary, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds fun. Okay, so tell me what all is going to be on the agenda.
Well, so we're hoping to launch this, what is going to become a series of events that we've got planned out through the fall, and we've got some speakers lined up for the spring as well. And the idea is to have a community conversation about science, how science impacts our daily lives, and the power of science and the interest that we have in these big questions that we've all been asking.
Getting people excited about science. Yeah.
Exactly.
What could be more exciting than talking about extraterrestrials?
Not much. Not much.
I just want to know one thing. Will ancient alien theory be part of the discussion?
Oh, theory
and
is
will,
a strong
will
word.
The guy from Ancient Aliens with, you know, Giorgio, will someone like him be at this event? Because then I would be there right away.
Well, I don't want to turn you away by saying no, but
I'm joking.
Yeah,
this
of
is
course.
A serious discussion. There's right?
It's a serious discussion about something that a lot of people have thought a lot about. And if people are anything like me, growing up thinking about aliens and being informed by sometimes some really good movies on the subject, I'm always blown away by having new discussions with new people who have been thinking about this for a long time, opening up the door to some black box of ideas that I've never even considered before.
Now, on the bill, you have two PhDs from UNF, John Anderson and Jack Hewitt, and they're going to debate, I guess, whether or not there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe.
Not quite so sure if they're going to debate. We actually don't know everything about what it is. We're just kind of going to turn them loose a little bit. But I think that they are going to discuss a little bit. It'd be fun if they kind of battle each other and put on boxing gloves. Mm-hmm. That would be fun.
What does the science say about the probability of alien life?
Well, it's
in the galaxy.
So we know that there are infinite number of galaxies, which is something that's really difficult to even fathom. Mm-hmm. And so the likelihood that this one planet on this one galaxy is the only one in an infinite number of galaxies that has any kind of intelligent life is probably pretty small. It's more likely that there is something out there. But I think one of the big questions is, does that life form look like we do, as we've seen in plenty of movies, or is it a different kind of thing altogether that, again, is going to be really difficult to wrap our heads around?
Right. Beyond our human comprehension.
Right.
Yeah. And so, as you pointed out, pop culture has been obsessed with this for so long that we all have these ideas about alien life, basically that we got from the movies and TV. And
in some cases, really, really
not science, but from entertainment.
Yeah. And in some cases, really well founded. Right. So you can get some really good ideas. One of my favorite movies about aliens is Contact.
Great movie.
I loved it.
Jodie Foster.
One of my favorite reasons for that movie is that they never show the alien.
Right, you never see them. When the alien appears to her, he looks like her late father because he figures that's easier for her to deal with.
So cool.
Yeah.
But it's worth noting that tomorrow, I think that they might mention a bit about life on other places because, you know, when we talk about aliens, it's hard to consider that maybe just microbially filled planets with oceans that are filled with single-celled organisms. We don't like to think about that as aliens, and that's not what they're going to discuss. What they're going to discuss are technologically advanced civilizations, if we can use that word, but
higher intelligence
aliens. And so that's a little bit murkier to discuss the probabilities of intelligence in the universe.
Okay. And so this is coming up tomorrow night, 6:00 at Downtown Intuition Ale Works. Can anybody come out? Do you need a ticket?
No. This is open to anyone who has an interest in this question, anyone who's interested in science, anyone who's not interested in science but wants to grab a beer and have a good conversation. So we welcome everyone.
And this is the first of many, right, guys?
This is the first of many. We have, like, as I mentioned, a full slate of speakers for the fall lineup. The next one, which is going to occur on September 12th, is going to be about understanding, you know, should we trust surveys and what's the role of statistics in our daily lives? Because we're always thrown numbers and you know, there was a lot of talk about surveys in the wake of the election. And so we have experts from psychology and political science to come and have that discussion about, can we trust surveys and what do statistics even mean? Can we find valid results in, you know, doing a sample population study and things like that?
That's a good one too. But the alien one, I have to say, you're kicking it off with a great, great one. It's a discussion of the case for ET, the first ever Science on Tap, tomorrow night at 6:00 at Intuition Ale Works. Stop by, grab a beer, and talk science with Josh Gellers and Eddie Whistler, the creators of the series Science on Tap. Have fun, guys.
Yep, my first beer is going to be with Josh, and we'll discuss the infinite number of galaxies comment that he just made.
It's going to be a fun night. That's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.